Okay. So again, my name is Rabbi Jeff Sachs. I work for an organization here in Jerusalem called Atid and the Web Yeshiva, webyeshiva.org, maybe you've heard of it, and I've had ongoing involvement here at this great institution at Pardes off and on over the years. I was asked to speak about Shai Agnon, which maybe if we have an opportunity to meet on a different occasion, I'll explain to you my interests in Shai Agnon and how I have come to do a bit of teaching and writing about that in these days. I do give some courses in English at the, I see a few people are here that were at the series that we had in the Beit Agnon. You know, we're only a few blocks away from Agnon's house, and we'll be having another one before Rosh Hashanah. So if anyone's interested, you can give me your email before you leave, and I'll make sure you get the information about that and about other series that we'll have there, both at the Beit Agnon and online as well. It's appropriate that we should be studying an Agnon story today for three reasons. Number one, today is Agnon's birthday. Agnon said he was born on Tisha B'Av, 1888. Now, this is not true. It's one of the layers of midrashicizing, that of storytelling, of story weaving that he did with his own biography. Agnon, of course, was not even born Agnon. His birth name was Shmuel Yosef Chachkis. Agnon was a pen name that he created for himself, which then kind of stuck as his family name, as was the fashion when people came in Aliyah. They often Hebrewized their names. So it stuck as his family name as well. He was actually born in 1887. Pushing off the year of your birth for a year was often a handy tactic to also delay the problem of conscription, of having to deal with getting out of the army for at least another year. He was actually born near Tisha B'Av in August of 1887, but he always said he was born on Tisha B'Av 1888, the 8th of the 8th, August 8th, 1888. If you check the calendar, Tisha B'Av in 1888 didn't even fall out on August 8th. So it's you built into the midrashicizing is the hint that this is not the biography, but the midrash. The fictional biography. The second reason that it's appropriate to study Agnon on Tisha B'Av. Anybody have a few-second note? You know, they're redesigning the money now, so I won't be able to do this for much longer. Next year we'll have all new figures on the bills. If you have a you can keep it, you know. If you have a 50 shekel note, most people overlook this, but here on this, you know, the iconic picture of Shai Agnon, you know, on the fifth, with the big velvet yarmulke, along the side, and this is a picture of the house. This is the study where he did all the writing that has thousands of volumes. In the back, here's his clipboard and his glasses and his pen. He would write standing up at a stand, but not too dissimilar from this one, doing most of his writing. Anybody been to the house? Anybody taken a tour of the house? You see it there. But here, in tiny letters along the side, is a quote, perhaps the most famous quote from the Nobel Prize speech. December 1966, he's awarded the Nobel Prize. He goes to Sweden. He makes the speech in front of the King of Sweden. It's fascinating for its particularism. You read it, parts of it read like a she'ur. One imagines what the King of Sweden was sitting there, like listening to it in translation. You know, thinking, like, what's that rabbi yammering on about? But this is what he said. And if your eyes are good enough, you can read along. He read, the fashion was he read the first few paragraphs in Hebrew, and then the rest, or the whole thing, was then read aloud on his behalf in English, so that everybody else, the other 99.9% of the people there, could understand what he was talking about. But that, they do that, if you don't speak, you know, one of the big languages, I think that's the way they do it in Nobel. So he writes here, Mitoch katastrofa historit, shehechriv Titus melech Romi et Yerushalayim, V'gala Yisrael me'artzo, nolareti ani ba'achat me'orei ha'gola. Because of the historical catastrophe that Titus, king of Rome, destroyed Jerusalem, and the Jewish people were exiled from their land, because of that historical catastrophe, I was born in one of the cities of the diaspora. Aval tamid domer... What?
The
Golan.
Not the diaspora,
the exile. The exile, the exile. Aval b'chol et tamid domeh hayiti alai kemi shenolad v'yushalayim. But nevertheless, I always imagined myself as one who was born in Jerusalem. So that, not just here in this speech, but in many stories, you mentioned you read the story Hamit Pachat, the kerchief, the idea of his writing, his whole project of writing this canon of literature, modern Hebrew literature, is somehow a response to a historical circumstance, and that historical circumstance is not trying to capture, merely trying to capture a world that's lost in Eastern Europe, but it's a historical circumstance that starts with Tisha B'Av, with the Churban, with the destruction of the temple and with the destruction of the settlement of the Jewish people here in Eretz Yisrael, and the dispersion, the exile of the Jews to the four corners of the earth. And everything that he's doing is somehow resonating off of that. So that's a second reason that it's worthwhile paying attention to Agnon all year long, but particularly with resonance on Tisha B'Av. And a third reason, at least to learn this story, is this is a story about Sinat Chinam, about baseless hatred. You have on the source sheet, the Gemara and Yuma, you know, there are many different explanations, you know, like Jews. You ask them, like, you know, what is this? And you get a lot of different answers. So this is the most famous answer. Like, this is the answer, poke Chazi Venira, go stop a little kid on the street and ask him, Tisha B'Av, why was the temple destroyed? This is the answer that he'll give you. Why was the Bayit Rishon destroyed? The first temple was destroyed because of three things. Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayot, V'Shfichat Damim. Because of idolatry, immorality, Gilui Arayot, the particular connotation of sexual immorality, and bloodshed, murder. Aval Mikdash Sheni, the second temple, but at the time of the second temple, the Jewish people, they were righteous and they studied and they davened and they get tzedakah and they helped people out and everybody was nice to each other, more or less. Why were they destroyed? Because sinat shahaita bo sinat chinam. Because there was a level, an element, a component of baseless hatred that was a cancer on the society. And that teaches you that Sinat Chinam is Shkula Keneged, is equivalent to all these other prime, terrible, terrible sins. And not just that, but the implication is that the first temple was destroyed, and not so long after we came back and we were allowed to return and to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, second temple is destroyed because of Sinat Chinam, because of baseless hatred, and we're still suffering the consequences. And we're still suffering the consequences. So Sinat Chinam is the topic, Machloket, a division within the society, is the topic of this particular story. This is a story called Shalom Olamim, translated here as Peace Everlasting. It's unfortunate that there, not everything in Agnon has yet been translated. Yeah, there's more copies here, and there's copies of the story in Hebrew if somebody wants it. Not everything that Agnon wrote has yet been translated, although most of the major novels have been. But even like some of the short stories that haven't translated, like this, for example, it's not collected up. There are a number of collections, anthologies of Agnon's stories collected so that you can get them. This is in a journal from 1965. There was a journal called, I think it still exists, called Conservative Judaism. It's a quarterly journal of philosophy and history and, you know, things of that, published by the conservative movement in the United States. And at a certain point, they, you know, in the 60s, when Agnon was, you know, at the height of his fame, this is, you know, a year before he's given the Nobel Prize. So they would translate stories would appear in translation. And so unless you know that it's there and have access to it at the library or something, or happen to have a copy on a shelf, you don't have it. So here's a copy of this story, which most people don't have access to. It appears as part of a series of short stories, all of them satires, collected together called Sefer HaMedina. The book of the Medina, the book of the state. Now that's not you don't go to the store and buy that. That's a section within another volume. This volume called Samuch Venire, which was published in 1952, has in it a section called the Sefer HaMedina, or Prakim Mitoch HaSefer Medina, chapters from the book of the Medina, the book of the state, as if these were kind of, either these were, it was a work in progress, or these were, you know, kind of the only remaining chapters, you know, like selections from this book, you know, that, you know, we don't have, you know, that maybe it existed only in his imagination. And they're all satires. Now, Agnon didn't write normally, he didn't write satires straight out, generally speaking. There's satirical elements in the other stories. He favored much more heavily the genre of irony in all of his stories. And he wrote, of course, in wide variety of genres, from the almost microscopic short story to the 700-page novel and everything in between. He wrote imitating the Midrash. Then he would write a story that was imitating the Hasidic tale. Then he would write something in the form of the what was then modern early 20th century novel. But in all of them, he favors irony, but not so much satire. But here, in this case, he wrote a few satirical pieces. He writes a number of satirical pieces, all of which have to do with life here in Medina Israel, even though a number of them were written before Yom HaAtzmaut 1948. They were satires on Jewish life, on our attempt to create a society, to create the mechanisms of governing ourselves. And they all share different themes. There's one that makes fun of taxes. It's called Al Hamisim, if you catch the pun. If not, I can't explain it. There are a number of others. I'll make references as we go along. This one is called Shalom Olamim. And it satirizes the division within society, and sadly, in the 60, 65 years since it was published, or more, in the 70, it was written probably in the mid-40s. It was published in this book in 1952, but it was written, you know, but what else? Oh, because nobody got around to translating it until it was published in Hebrew in 52, but then they translated it. I mean, there are things that were written in the 30s that have only recently been translated.
Mm-hmm. But, how do you see the definition of a satire?
A satire is, well, again, Agnon is not he's not the Mark Twain. He's not the Jew. Who is the Jewish Mark Twain? Shalom Aleichem. Right? You want Jewish satire, look at Shalom Aleichem. I mean, not just by watching a Fiddler on TV, but... satire is a kind of humorous skewering of often public figures or society as a whole, with an attempt to try to better them. Right? An attempt to try to hold them up to scrutiny, but in a humorous way, with the hope that maybe someone will learn the lesson. Agnon had said, here you have on the first page, this quote here in the middle, this is from the Pticha. So he took all these stories, they were written over a number of different times, and then he collects them together in this little machzor of stories. When he got older, it's fair to point out, when he got older, he said that and who knows if he really meant this or not, he said that he regretted having written these stories, because after all, we have only one Medina, we have only one nation, and we should be nice to her. But who knows? So here in the Pticha, in the kind of the preface to this cycle of stories, he writes, "Miyom she'amadati al da'ati, bikashi lechtov sefer al maaseh ha'medina." Right? I always wanted to write this kind of book. I'll give a very loose translation. "Aval kol eimat she'kerafti el ha'malacha, nirtati lachura." But whenever I attempted to write a book about the state, it was difficult. I had to withdraw. Shaharei ha-medina eina keshar kol davar sheish bo ruach chayim. The state is not like any other living entity. Shemechaye et ha-sofer u-meir einav lirot v'lechtov im l'shevet im l'chesed. Right? So anything you want to write about, somebody you want to write about somebody you know, and he often would include historical figures or thinly disguised historical figures in his novels. So you look at this living creature in front of you, And, you know, he kind of guides you on what to write, either critically or favorably. The state is not merely a collective of the people that live here, that, you know, happen chance happen to, like, fill these borders. What's the state? What's Jewish society in Israel? It's a spiritual idea. It's an abstract idea. It's a ruchani idea, which, if you want to, you know, make it mean something, if Herzl was right, Ein zu agada. If you want to be more than an agada, if you want to be real, you know, place where there are roads and stoplights and police officers and an army and a school system and you fill in the blank, so it has to go from being an abstract spiritual idea to a gashmi, to a physical idea, from metaphysics to physics. But once it has become an actual real-world, non-abstract entity, it then once again becomes abstract. Because we think about it, I mean, I hope we all think about it, not in terms of, you know, the Arnona bill. Right? Although it's also that. It's also that. But it would be nice if we could...
Another reading, though.
Yeah?
But I see. Or say atzma ruchani, and as it makes itself out to be something that is spiritual.
Okay, maybe.
It has a pretense.
Right. No, I don't think that's what he meant, though. So he says that's why it's difficult to write about this. So then he has the story here. It's a short story. We can read it together. If you'd like, we can take a few minutes and you can all, you know, we can read it to ourselves. We can go over it quickly to ourselves or, you know, together in pairs and then come back and go over it together. So why don't we, let's take 10-12 minutes. Right? 10-12 minutes. Read it to yourself, or better yet, you know, you can turn to your partner next to you, to the person you don't yet know next to you, and just read through it quickly, and then we'll go over it again. You can skip in the English on page 35, the paragraph that begins "They decided to send deputations," until the new paragraph on page 36. You could skip that. Just to miss. On page 30, the middle of 35 to the top of 36, you can skip, probably. So first of all, Sefer Medina, what's he playing off of with the title of the collection? What other book is called Sefer Medina? Literally the book of the state. There's another book by them. No. The Republic by Plato, which in Hebrew is translated as Sefer HaMedina. What? What's the Republic by Plato about? It's a philosophical text, largely political philosophy, social philosophy, on the proper fine-tuning, care and maintenance of civil society, of political society, of what it means when people come together to accomplish something, you know, in one city-state or in one medina, in order to, for the betterment of the citizens, or at least the landed non-slave citizens, or whomever it is that you're addressing your work to. So right away, the whole title takes on these grandiose, you know, pretensions that that's what the book is. So let's start the story. Shalom Olami, peace everlasting. Peace everlasting is not something that we Jewish people have known too much. We have periods of better, periods of worse, but like somehow we always manage to shoot ourselves in the foot. We can't read every word together, so we'll skip around. The country was in great trouble. There had been no trouble like it since the days when the country was founded. The heavens did not send down rain, and the earth did not yield its produce. If you have the Hebrew in front of you, you can see it. If not, even in reading, when you read in translation, often a lot just washes over you by nature. But even reading in translation, you can hear the biblical cadences here. The heaven did not send down rain, and the earth did not yield its produce. It was as if heaven and earth had vowed to make an end of the surviving remnant. The Sheirit HaPleta, 1940s, we came, we walked out of Auschwitz, we came straight to the Holy Land, we built a country, and now there's a drought. The supply of food decreased, and the number of bodies swollen with hunger increased. A grain of wheat was going for gold, a barley for silver. Milk had turned to water, and there was no water, for the Lord had not yet sent rain upon the earth. Skip the next paragraph. Troubles never come singly. When all strengths had failed, a rumor was heard that enemies surrounded the country. So there's a real enemy, and there's another enemy. So since trouble loves company, since one tzara always brings another tzara, so we have these problems at home. We have this drought and famine at home, and surrounded on all sides are the Arab armies. The enemy had not yet entered the country, but was very near. Even in normal times, the country imports food. Now that the country was surrounded by enemies, neither food nor drink could enter the country. Next paragraph. The enemy, seeing that there was no one who could stand against him, drew nearer. He from without, the famine from within, we thought that the trouble had already reached its peak, but an even greater trouble. Now here's a third tzara. We have famine and drought at home. We have enemies breathing down our neck on the border, but there's an even greater problem. And what's this greater problem? An even greater trouble appeared, for the storehouse of trouble is bottomless, and there is no trouble which is not surpassed by another. What's this trouble, this greater trouble? The country should have anticipated calamity with counsel, meaning before the calamity came, we should have gotten together and solved our problems. But the citizens of the country are divided into two sects. Mechulakim le'shtei kitot in the Hebrew. And that itself is the problem. The source of our problem is the division within the nation. And what are these two sects? The covered heads and the bared heads.
Kisui Rosh
and Vagalui Rosh. And whatever one sex tries, the other foils. You know the Dr. Seuss, the Sneetches?
Yeah.
Right? It's straight out of there. And that's also a brilliant satire. Even each of the sects is split within itself, one faction hating the other. Perhaps more than the enemy hates the covered heads and the bare heads put together. This country has a tradition that its founding fathers were Jews, and of course it's customary for Jews to cover their heads. So some of them cover their heads. But why do some of them bare their heads? They consider themselves in the category of Jews who lived before the time of Revelation, who had not yet been commanded to cover their head. Therefore they bare their heads. This is obvious satire. And since one group covers the head and the other group bears the head, they're split and they hate each other. These sneetches have stars. Those are plain-bellied sneetches. They can't get along. But that's not it. There's another layer of machloket. But why should the covered heads hate each other? Since all of them cover their head. Well, some wear skull caps and others wear hats. Some wear square skull caps and others wear round skull caps. Some are large, as anger, and others smaller than a louse. Some are of rags and others of silk. Right? Some wear a kippah shugah, some wear a black kippah, some wear this, some wear that. You know, some are big, some are small. So obviously you can't get along with somebody who has a kippah that's different than yours. And one does not need a head especially, just so long as it's covered. And why should bared heads hate each other? Since all right, so another is Mela. The people with the... He's careful not to say, like, he didn't talk about dati and chiloni. Right? This is the sneeches. There's the bared heads and the covered heads. So Mela, the covered heads, I understand why they can't get along with each other, because they don't. It's not like there's only one type of head covering, one uniform. There's a lot of variety. So if I cover my head and you cover your head, but we have different head coverings, obviously I'm not going to be able to agree with you. But the bared heads, they're all bare. And why should the bared heads hate each other, since all of them bear the head? Well, some of them have wavy hair and others cut it short. Some are bald and others have high forehead. And one does not need a head especially, just so long as it is bare. So this is the greater trouble. We've got problems, foreign and domestic, but our problem, our first problem is that we're the Jewish people. We can't get it together. We can't, like, figure out how to get it together. Chapter 2. There was in that country one man who belonged neither to the covered heads nor to the bared heads. Now, this character in the story, who appears in the other stories, or some of the other stories in the Sefer HaMedina, sometimes he refers to himself as the Baal Sefer HaMedina, the author of the Sefer HaMedina, which after all was Agnon. Well, Agnon, you know, we in the iconic picture, he has that big black velvet yarmulke, right? We were in America a while back, and we met someone who's like, you know, Jewish, like their Jewish religious life is quite provincial. And, you know, they're an Orthodox Jew of a particular stripe in America. And at the time, our kid was very little. You know how kids here, they wear those big Bukharian kippot, you know, the multicolored ones with the design and the thing. So this woman said, "Oh, does he always wear that type of yarmulke?" So my son said, "What's a yarmulke?" Didn't even know that word. She said it's so ethnic.
In the Hebrew, we use the word yarmulke.
Right. But as one of the samples of type of kippot, type of head covering. So this guy, Agnon, he has got this big black yarmulke. I mean, there's nothing else you could call that than a yarmulke, right? But he didn't always wear that yarmulke. There was a period in his life, in his youth, where he did not wear a yarmulke. Where he did not, at least outwardly, was not ritually observant. He never gave any explanation for this.
What did he do when he was living in Europe, when he was back?
So in other words, Agnon, just a quick biography. Agnon was born in 1888, or really 1887. In 1907, at the age of 19 or 20, he comes on Aliyah and he lives in Yafo. He grows up in a completely traditional environment of complete immersion in life of tradition and Torah study. When he shows up here in Yafo, hoping to pursue a career as a writer, the kippah is not on his head. He lives in Yafo briefly in Jerusalem until 1912, when he goes back to Europe, not to Buchach. He's from Galicia, in what's today the western Ukraine. It was culturally part of Polish Galicia. But he goes back to Germany. He goes to Germany, where he goes to try to round out his general education and his reading in Western literature, which he knew was necessary for him to make the leap to be a really great writer. World War I breaks out, then he gets married and has kids, and his plans of a quick return to Palestine are delayed, as is the case for many people in the diaspora. And he only comes back in 1924. In 1924, his house burned down in Germany, destroying his library of many thousands of volumes, as well as the manuscripts of at least two nearly completed works. He had not backed them up, you know, with some remote backup at the time. And he says, "That's it. We're coming back to this time to Jerusalem." And he brings the family back in the fall of 1924. They live at that time in the center of town on what today is in Nachlat Shiva, in Rehov Shammai. And when he comes back in 1924, the kippah has mysteriously returned, and he has returned to a life of traditional observance. He never discussed it. He never explained it. If people would ask him about it, if people would ask him about any kind of detail in his biography, instead of giving you an answer, he would tell you a story. And then you'd have to try to figure out like what the story means. But so there was this period of time when he was not traditionally observant, although
he was not observant in Germany.
No. Again, he wasn't. You know, the exact nature of what he was and wasn't doing isn't 100% clear. But today we would say he wasn't an Orthodox Jew. But that's kind of superimposing our current vocabulary backwards. But for all intents and purposes, he was not observant. Although during this time he writes some of his most gripping religious works, stories that have the most profound religious meaning and wrestle with deeply religious themes and issues are written specifically at this period. Gershom Shalom, who met him when he was in Germany at the time, they were lifelong friends. Shalom was about 10 years younger than Agnon. So Shalom has this, if you want, you can email me and I'll send it to you. He has this kind of reflection on Agnon. And he says that even during that period when he met him in Germany, when Agnon was not ritually observant, he has a line there where he says something like, he still presented himself as the bearer of the tradition. Like somehow, it was a line something like that. So there was in that country a man who belonged neither to the covered heads nor to the bare heads. Well, maybe he's talking now about himself. He was just a man. If he had to be classified, he would bare his head. Otherwise, he would not. He saw that a national disaster seemed escapable. He said, well, I will pray for rain before the entire country dies of starvation. Right? In other words, there's a famine. We just did it this past winter. You know, we're used to this. It doesn't rain a lot here. And even now when we buy water, we import water from Chutz La'aretz, and they bring tankers full of water, right? We always get nervous about like how many people wake up in the morning, the first thing they do is check, you know, where the Kav Adom is on the Kinneret. So what do? We daven for rain. We add into the tefillah something about the rain. So he says, look, we have troubles, what should we do? We should daven for rain. This should always come first, pleading to the merciful one for mercy. But it had been forgotten by the citizenry, for it is human nature to forget that what we should remember. That man prostrated himself, nishtatach in Hebrew. That verb will come back. He prostrated, nishtatach, from the same shoresh as shetach or shatiach. Right? Shatiach. Right? Shatiach. Right? Carpet. Right? This is a shatiach because it covers the shetach. It covers the ground. The territory. That's why the territories are called the shtachim. Right? So he when you would prostrate yourself, like they used to in the Beit HaMikdash, when you fall, when the Kohanim would fall, like when we do still on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, it's called Hishtateach, because you like kind of everybody gets their own little territory that they fall down on. He prostrated himself in prayer and in supplication before the Holy One and pleaded for rain to fructify the desolate earth that its children would not die of starvation. Kadosh Baruch Hu had been anticipating the prayers of the citizens, for he is a God who desires loving kindness and wishes his creature well. Now to allow them to eat their bread with clear conscience. This is, in the Hebrew, it's more clear what he's talking about, although not really. It's a quote from the Zohar. The Zohar has this idea of Nehemah de Kisufa, that it's not good to get something for nothing. I mean, we all know this. I mean, if we're trying, we have raised children, or if we're in the midst of struggling to raise children, we know that it's not good that they should get something for nothing, because it makes them unappreciative, makes them spoiled. It's good to work for your bread. Right? So the idea that God would give, why Zohar is dealing with the question of, why does God need our prayers? Right? God knows what we need. Right? He doesn't need me to ask for it. Since if there's something paradoxical about prayer. We say God is all-knowing, he's all-powerful. So if he's all-knowing, all-powerful, what does he need me to daven for? What does he need me to ask for my needs? So it's not that he should know what I need. It's that I should articulate my needs. And by my articulating my needs, that will help me be appreciative of knowing what I have. So the Zohar has this idea, that's what prayer is really about. So Agnon is riffing off of that passage in the Zohar, is to allow them to eat their bread with a clear conscience. But in the translation, the translation elides over this idea. He ordained the order of prayer so that they should first pray and then be rewarded, just as a cantor takes payment for his prayer from the gabbai. However, since the citizens of the country were preoccupied with arguments and debates, they did not have time to remember their Creator, who redeems and saves and is merciful in all times of trouble and distress, and who has it in his power to benefit his creatures if they're deserving of deliverance and mercy. So they did not remember that they should remember until people heard one man had pleaded for rain. So nobody thinks, oh, well, we should daven. If we daven, then we won't have the problem of the drought at home. Then we'll have food, and then we'll be able to fight against our people out there. But nobody just simply, it never occurred to anyone. No one remembered. Then there's this passage where he says that like, everybody was alarmed by this idea that one person went out and prayed. It's like four lines from the bottom. One small question was asked in the newspapers. This man, who sent him? Whose name had he been received in God's presence? Who does he think he is? Going and davening, going and praying. They began making disagreeable remarks about a little man who cloaks himself in greatness. And they were complaining that God had left the great man of the country to become, God had left the great men of the country, the politicians, to become attached to this little, this pisher, this nobody, who belongs to no party. And here, party, in other words, it's the two sides, but it's also this idea that everything gets done by nature in a, at least in a democracy, which we're not yet prepared to give up on. Things get done by parties, by sectarian interests, by battling it out. And that's the way things function, but there's a cost to that.
Sorry, I need to understand how he didn't belong to either group, because either he covered,
or
he didn't.
No, you're asking biographically about Agnon?
No.
Because he says, sometimes like, if I need to scratch my head, I take it off, and sometimes I want to have this side, put it back on. There's, like, I'm not going to be, you can't classify me. You can't put me in a box. You can't say, you know, this is what it is, right? You want me to tick a box? I'm not going to do that. So this idea that, like, you know, like he goes and he davenes, and everybody stops and says, who does he think he is? He's going to daven. Right? Why? Because what's the danger with him davening? Why should anybody better be bothered by that? Right? So it becomes like this snowball effect. And once an opening had been made for talkers, all thinkers in the country came out to disclose their opinion that act was liable to destroy the very foundations of the country. Not to mention law and order. For anyone without authorization from the community who sets himself up as a representative can be considered as one of the dissolute criminals who respect nothing destructive of the country's basic laws. Meaning, what's the worst thing that could happen now? This guy's prayers will be answered. Because that'll show what? No, that the talkers... Right, the talkers and the parties, they're not necessary. They don't, it's like these... Look, you can argue with them yes or no. We'll see if they're going to win. But these guys out in the tents, anybody been out to the tents? Okay. So they're really trying to keep the politicians at arm's length. And either they realize that they're going to do it alone, or they're going to realize that nothing can get done without the politicians. But
that's part of the truth.
What?
That's part of the truth.
It's, okay. I'm not here to talk about current events. It's Tisha B'Av.
I'm saying right? The way you represent it is part of what is not all about this.
Okay. But this whole idea of the kadur sheleg of the snowball, like, you know, like one guy goes to daven mincha and that's going to destroy the whole state. So this is an idea that appears again and again in the other stories. There's one of the stories in the collection is called Klipat Tapuach Zahav, the orange peel. It was just a Shokan just put out a collection. It's very nice. Three short stories. Agnon didn't really write children's stories. But he wrote certain stories that are certainly enjoyable by children, you know, even though a lot's going to be going over their head. And in fact, you know, kids still read some Agnon in school, the Maaseh Ha'ez and the Mitpachat and others. So they put out this collection of three stories with illustration, and it's in Hebrew. Three short stories that are kid-friendly with nikud, with vowels, and glossary, and illustrations. And it's called Klipat Tapuach Zahav for the title story. Klipat Tapuach Zahav, the orange peel. Right? You can get it in the Stamatskis. If not, they can order for you. So this story, which is the title story of this collection, it has this, it has Maaseh Ha'ez, you know, the very well-loved story of the fable of the goat, and another one called Me'oyev Le'oyev, from friend to foe. I think it's translated as Hebrew. which is about his house and the winds and Talpio. So the Kli Batipoch Zahav is in his collection. What happens? Somebody's crossing the street and they drop an orange peel on the street. Someone else is carrying packages. She trips on the orange peel, she falls, and all of her packages go scattering. Somebody else comes along and trips on her v'chad gadya, and the story goes on until it says, Hol mehuma, all of Yerushalayim is stopped. You imagine it taking place at the corner of Yafo and King George, you know, which once upon a time was the center of the universe, before there were malls, before everything else. And it's like a chad gadya story. It's like, you know, like a chain reaction accident of causes. And everybody's standing around going, who put this orange peel here? Where are the, we pay our taxes. How come nobody picked up this orange peel? And as they're arguing, complaining about the orange peel and about the Iriya who doesn't come to pick up the orange peel and to collect the garbage and to whatever, more and more people are tripping and falling in this kind of slapstick kind of thing. So one guy, the Sefer Bala Medina, sees what's going on and he thinks, I'll pick up the orange peel. He picks up the orange peel. He throws in the garbage. And they come along and they arrest him. And I say, who do you think you are? Collecting garbage without a license. So that theme, you know, resonates throughout the stories. All the ink spilled by the pens was absorbed bodily. The entire country began coughing up such things until nobody could say anything that had not already been said by his comrade. The two of them would now be astonished, for they had been opponents throughout the years, but now they were of one opinion. And not only is their opinion the same, but their speech as well, even their tongue, which is thought to say to them. So in other words, now what's uniting everybody? Their opposition to this one no good nick who's doubling. Skip ahead to page 36 in the paragraph. Something which at first appeared to be supernatural began happening quite naturally. How so? All of the country's hoarders of foods began inciting and arousing the great men of the country. The covered heads covered heads, and the bared heads, until all of them gathered at a place called, now here, there's a lot of wordplay in the Hebrew, which can't be translated. Here they translate it as Tongi. This must be a pun on some, isn't there a British town by this name? Right? So in Hebrew, it's Siftotayim. Siftotayim, there's no such place, right? It says they gather in a place called Siftotayim, Milashon Safa, lip. Where do they gather? So they all gather to figure out what to do in a place called lip service. In a place called blah, blah, blah. Right? There's no good way to translate it. A place where it's, you know, just like, you know, lippity lip. They're all just, you know, gamming away at the, you know, they're going to talk and talk and talk and talk and talk because that's all they know how to do. So the translator translates it as tonguey. For everyone whose tongue serves him well can master the citizens of the country. They began discussing in earnest what to do, lest on the morrow rain should fall and the earth yield its produce, and all law and order will be overcome, since the rain would not be falling, because the heads of state agreed that it should, that the country needed rain, but because of that man who had gone off by himself to pray for rain. And this affair was likely to bring destruction and annihilation in its wake, for any person at all could then do whatever his heart desires without the agreement of the nation's leaders. So now there's this plan. They come up with this strategy. They need to figure out a way to make sure that if it rains, the rain won't have its effect. So they're going to put a shatiach, right? A carpeting, right? Joel, grab that over there. They're going to, like a chuppah. They're going to make the hope, and they're going to put it over the whole country. But in order to do that, you need someone to weave this big, I didn't bring this from home, it wasn't a prop or anything, like a big chuppah, but in order to do that, you need somebody to like make the thing, and then you'll have to have poles, you know, put all over the place to hold it up. And everybody was happy. Everybody was happy. The Kisui Rosh were happy because it's like one big kippah. Right? Like it's a covering for everybody's head. And the Galui Rosh were happy because they like anything that serves as a mechitza, as a divider between heaven and earth. So everybody was able to see in it what they wanted, and they could agree that this will be the solution. We're going to make this big umbrella that's going to go over the whole country, so if it rains, ha ha ha, the water won't get to the earth, and the earth won't give its produce, and this guy won't undermine all of law and order in society. What's going on at this moment while they're doing this? What?
He's praying.
Everyone's starving to death, and we're surrounded on all sides by hostile armies.
Biting off the nose is not the place as well.
So skip ahead to page 30, 37. Immediately thereafter, they gathered for a second meeting and appointed measurers for the entire... Now, but in order to get this big public works project done, that's complicated, right? I mean, you know, like anybody ever have them... like the area ever come to like fix the water main in front of your house? Yeah? That doesn't take a lot of time. They're building... We live in Efrat. They're building a new roundabout or something. It's not even a stoplight. At the entrance to Efrat. And it's like shut down the whole town for 6 months. Like you wonder, what in the world are they doing all day? Immediately thereafter, they gathered for a second meeting and appointed measurers for the entire country to measure the length and the width of the land. And they selected a committee to gather all the country's weavers to weave a carpet the size of the country. They selected another committee to gather all the country's carpenters to make poles from which the carpet would be hung. All these va'adot... Every vad had to have, every task had to have a vad. They selected another committee to determine the location of the poles. Another committee which they selected was a committee of forcers who knew how to give advice on how to force poles into the ground. They selected another committee to supervise the workers. And then they made just an ordinary committee, which was divided into two sections. Stam Committee Aleph and Stam Committee Bet. After all the committees had been appointed, they appointed a vad havadot. Right? The committee of all the committees. Anybody here on the shul committee? Right? So you know, like, we have this in our blood. After all these committees had been selected, a special committee was selected to name the carpet. Now here there's a kind of sub-satire, Joel, you'll appreciate this, on the Vad HaLashon. Agnon was a member of what was called the Vad HaLashon, which was established, the language committee, the Hebrew language committee, which was established by Eliezer ben Yehuda, and then later it became the Akademia LaLashon HaEvrit, the Hebrew language academy. Everybody likes to point out the irony of the fact that the Hebrew Language Academy's name has a Greek word in it, academia. If you go onto their website, they actually have an explanation for why that's okay. So Agnon had these ongoing debates with the academy and with the Vad HaLashon on language usage. And it's fascinating to think that once upon a time in this country, at least, there was like a level of culture where this would take place. Agnon would write a story. Most of his short stories would first appear in the newspaper, in Haaretz. Usually, because his publisher was Shokin, his patron was Shokin, who owned the newspaper. And then people would like say, Agnon used this word. Like, you know, what do you, like, why did he use this word instead of that word? And there'd be debates about it. And then Agnon would have to, like, write a response where he, like, lists, like, all of the Marim Mekamot, all of the sources from the Bible through the Mishnah, through the Midrash, through the Talmud, through the Rishonim and the Achronim, showing the history of this word and why he chose that word and why he was right and they were wrong and etc. So there's also this kind of sub-satire here about in the choosing of the name, like how they would make up names. The Vad HaLashon, there'd be something new and they'd say, we need a word for this. We need a word for this. And the Vad HaLashon would meet and they would decide the word for this is Sachrachok. And then everybody kept calling it a telephone. In other words, we, the people, vote on what word gets used. But officially, there's an official word. Matos or Aviron? Which one is it? Well, now everybody says Matos. My mother-in-law, who's a woman of a certain generation who grew up in Zionist summer camps in America, so she still says Aviron. But most people say Matos. But this was a debate. This was actually a heated debate between Eliezer ben Yehuda, who said Aviron, and Bialik, who said Matos. And they each had reasons for why they said that word. So Matos went out over, and certain things ben Yehuda won, certain things... Right, so that was in some things Ben Yehuda won, other things his opponents won. It went back and forth. Ultimately, usage wins out. Ultimately, the way that we use the language determines what is proper usage. So a special committee was selected to name the carpet for everything which had to become a slogan as likely to make money. The money was certainly needed for the manufacture of the carpet and the construction of the poles, and especially for the support of the committees. All members of the committee gathered together for a meeting. They finally decided to give the naming of the hands into the hands of the Society Linguistica, the Linguistia Lishonia, right? He's also making fun of this kind of trend that all like new Hebrew words should end yud-hey, right? Being in charge of all linguistic matters, all of whose members are linguists and verbally verbal, except in all languages, among them members who are expert in the language of the country. All of the members gathered together and rented large buildings where they installed secretaries and aides and sat down to consider names, right? People are starving to death. Their enemies at the door, right? This guy's off davening, and they set up an office building, and they have secretaries, and they have committees, and the secretaries are probably bringing them coffee, and they're debating on what to call this thing. So in the end, they decide to call it protestia, right? Protest. Here, the translator calls it protesterific, in Hebrew, protestia. But then there's a debate. Is it protestia with a tet, or is it protestia with a tuf? Right, and then they have to go back and forth. But protestia, why? Because the whole thing is a protest. Page 38. Yes? So here the translator's taken some liberties in order to render the puns into English. Like the committee is protesterific with three R's or with two R's, but it's in the Hebrew. It's
this doesn't sound like an experience. There's a story that would come from 1932
Palestine. It's not, it's 19, it was 19, late 1940s. This story was already written after Komam Dina.
Oh, this story was
And then they have speeches about it, and the great men of the country don't lose sight of the major principle. They launched a drive for funds, right? They have pushkas, everybody has to donate to this thing. The bottom paragraph on page 38. They collected the donations and the contributions, and brought in weavers and carpenters. The weavers made the carpet, and the carpenters the poles, each craftsman using the characteristic color of his group, black coloring black, red red, blue blue. The work on the carpet was completed, and the work on the poles was finished. They hung the carpet on the poles and spread it out from one end of the country to the other. The citizens gaze at the carpet and rejoice at the protestia, and say, "What a lovely protestia, what a lovely protestia. Lawless men have sought to destroy all discipline, but our eyes are upon the protestia." What is this? Like, what's echoing here? Happy are those who have been privileged to see the restoration of the disciplines as right place in the Iranian nation. Oh, the Nachash and Nechoshet, or Yadav Shel Moshe. You know, like these times in the Midbar where there's some kind of symbol that we raise up, right, during Melchemet Amalek. Moshe's hands are raised up, and when Moshe's hands are up, we win, and when Moshe's hands are down, and the Mishnah says, well, the Mishnah Rosh Hashanah says why? It's not that Moshe's hands fight the war, but it's a funneler. That's not a good word. It's a device to focus a conduit. It's a lens to focus Kavana to heaven. And similarly in the Midbar, the Nachash and Nechoshet, they raise up this symbol. I mean, it's a very strange thing, since we're always very little wary about graven images and sculptures and things like that, but they raise up this thing, and after everybody's bitten by these snakes, and everybody looks up to heaven. It's not to look at the snake. The snake is not the object. It's the ends to get to the means to get to the end of looking to heaven and Kavana and Tshuva and all of those things. This is, we raise up the thing on the poles and everybody's looking at it and we're unified. But what are we unified in? In our protest. Which, again, we're not talking about current events. But there is a unity in, even in protest. The prayer of that man accomplished a little, and the will of the Holy One, praised be He, accomplished everything. Kadosh Baruch Hu produced the key for rain to open His good treasury, the heavens. The key, which had not been used for many years, had become rusty. And when the key was struck into the sky, an enormous noise was heard. The rusty key in the locks of the heavens as the sound of thunder before the rain. And from that rust, the heavens were blackened and were filled with clouds. And after the noise, rain began falling. The carpet split into shreds. What's he riffing off of here? What biblical echo do you hear here? Eliyahu Bahar Carmel. The coal, right? In other words, Eliyahu goes up to fight against the Nevi Ebal. Right? They have this whole sound and light show. The thunder and the lightning and the whirlwind and whatever. But where is God?
still small voice.
In the cold of Mamadaka, in the still small voice. In the voice of one little guy who sees a problem, he's going to go daven. And after the noise, rain began falling. The carpet split into shreds. The rain reached the earth and saturated the ground. For it is the way of the citizenry to do their deeds haphazardly, since the idea, not the deed, is the main thing. And so rain fell to slap at the face of every man. The colors of the carpet blurred, the black became red, the red became blue, the blue became black, or red, until it was impossible to tell the difference between black and red, and between red and blue. At the end, you don't know which is the original Sneetch and which is the Star Valley Sneetch, and it's right. But in other words, what's the satire here? Why does the rain get to the earth?
No. Well,
yeah. It's not the power of God, and it's not the power of this guy's prayer, as much as it is the rashlanut, the negligence, the shoddy workmanship of this whole project. What are you talking about? This huge national project. They invest billions of dollars and thousands of people working on hundreds of committees to get it done. But the idea is always better than the action, right? And when it comes to getting the job done, there's always like a little slipshodness, and it's and that's what does them in. That's what does them in. Even more powerful than the power of God. The author often has the opportunity to teach that there's no evil unaccompanied by goodness. And he still maintains this outlook and has no fear of mockers. However, just as there is no evil unaccompanied by goodness, so there is no goodness unaccompanied by evil, since in this world goodness and evil are intermingled. And everything good for this one is bad for that one. Since a great deal of rain did fall, causing the earth to yield its produce, bread to eat and water to drink, the hungry were happy, but the sated were sad, since the prices of all the food which they had hoarded went down and they suffered losses. And even the happiness of the great men of the country was incomplete. The covered heads, for their skull caps and hats had become mangled and wet, and the bared heads, for the rain had slapped at their bald pates. Now, for some reason unbeknown to me, the translator left off the end of the story. Yes. I taught the story a number of times in Ivrit, and only very recently I taught it for the first time in English, here at Pardes, and I said, but wait, the last line is missing. So if you go to the source sheet, the third source here, you have the last sentences. Achar shesiparnu keitzad niftara hadina min ha'ayev shebifnim. After we've explained, after we've told how the country was rescued from the enemy, the domestic, from the famine, chayvim anu l'saper keitzad higiyah ha'ayev shemibichutz l'milchama al ha'medina. So the rain only solves the problem of famine. But what about all the enemies that are at the door? Ela lo eit dvarim achshav. But now's not the time to tell the story of the Arab enemies that came to maraud us. Shel milchemet mitzvah u'milchemet chovah lanu be'oyev. Because the fight against the enemies foreign, that is milchemet mitzvah, an obligatory war. What's he doing in that last sentence? No. What's not a favorite?
The inner fighting between the
yeah,
you know,
but it's even sharper than that. That's correct, but
yeah, he's saying that people regard the internal wars as not time to respond, and therefore don't have time to deal with the external enemies.
No, I don't know if we've ever neglected really, you know, externally.
Well, he's saying that the external wars are the obligatory wars, so the bride leaves the vupa, everybody leaves what you're doing to go fight, he leaves riding to fight.
Okay.
So everything's been about all the words, they've been talking at each other, shouting at each other.
I mean, it's true that sometimes our foreign problems, sometimes when there's real tsara on the border or even terrorism at home, we all have been witness to the kind of unity, even if it's a passive, passing, fleeting kind of unity that comes about from that. But I think he's making a sharper, more satirical point.
He's saying when there's a real problem, and we should just pick up the orange peel. If there's a problem with war, then we should fight.
Right.
And not fight each other and waste our time okay. doing things that are irrelevant.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, think about this. I think if you look really carefully, he says, I don't have time to talk about that now. Why? Because that's milchemet mitzvah, milchemet chova. Meaning, these guys, not the problem that we just described and solved, but these guys on the border, that's milchemet chova. So by implication, what is this story about? Milchemet reshut. The war we choose to fight with ourselves. Right? So that the enemies will never get us. We'll destroy ourselves long before anybody can get us mibachutz. If the problem is the wars that we choose to fight with ourselves, and here, in other words, it's a pun which is so subtle that the word he's punning on doesn't even, this is a typical Agnonian style, right? He's making a pun on a word that doesn't even appear. He mentions Milchemet Mitzvah, Milchemet Chova. There's no reason for him to mention both of them. I mean, you can't read Agnon like it's Rashi, but you can't help yourself, right? Right? Milchemet Mitzvah, Milchemet Chova.
Those are
synonyms. And obligatory wars, mandatory wars. In halakha, in halachic literature, Milchemet Mitzvah, Milchemet Chova is the opposite of Milchemet Rishut, an optional war. The halakha has a notion of an optional war. There's a war of self-defense, that's an obligatory war, and as you mentioned, everybody has to go fight. It's self-defense. We have to save the Jewish people, we have to save the Jewish homeland. But there's also a notion of Milchemet Rishut, that the Jewish kings in the times of old were able to go out and, under certain circumstances, with the assent of the Sanhedrin, go out and fight wars, aggressive wars, in order to conquer territory, in order to, for whatever reason you would choose to fight a war. But that's not the kind of war we're talking about. Here, the Milchemet Rishut is the choice that we've made to be this divided people. And that's the source. When you live in a society like that, and unfortunately, I think we still do, to a certain degree, when you live in a society, well, when you live in Medina Israel, the whole question of religion and state, by definition, is going to come to the fore. The theme here is the challenge, not just here, but in other stories as well, is the challenge of finding place for the individual, the one guy that wants to go off and daven, within the collective. Now that's a much different topic, and that's a much more complicated topic. But the tension between communal religion and individual religion is a very difficult one. And it's something that Agnon thought that we didn't always get right. Agnon didn't often talk about like matters of public policy, and again, if they would ask him, like, what do you think about this or what do you think about that? He'd be evasive. But there's this letter that we have that he wrote to Ben Gurion at the bottom. There's a volume called Me Atzmi El Atzmi, From Myself to Myself. It's a collection of his letters and speeches and occasional nonfiction. So there's this letter that he wrote to Ben Gurion, and this is like a PS that he has at the end of the letter. This letter is from December 1958, Hanukkah Tavshin Yud Tet. He says, "Bershutcha osif davar shelo nishal." Ben Gurion had sent a letter to everyone, to every thinker and philosopher and people of the spirit and rabbis and professors and everything about the question of Mihu Yehudi. It's 1958. It was one of the, this topic of who is a Jew rears its head.
Brother Daniel.
I don't think this was Brother Daniel. Brother Daniel was later. But it was, periodic times, the question of who is a Jew rears its head, and this was one of the times. So Ben Gurion had this idea. He was going to send letters to everybody, not just in Israel. He sent in Chutzlar. It's also in that collection of letters of Rabbi Soloveitchik that came out not long ago. It was his letter that he responded to this to this question that Ben-Gurion sent out. And like Ben-Gurion, like I guess he felt like, you know, a lot of people would write, and then he'd be able to say, well, look, see, these people agree with me. And you know, I guess there are people that disagreed with him, but he didn't have to, like, deal with them. So Agnon wrote him a letter. So in the letter itself, Agnon said, look, I don't know what you want from me. You know, as far as I know, there's only the halacha. Look in the Shulchan Aruch, it'll tell you me or you or the. But that was typical. He didn't want to get involved in these types of things. But then he adds, this is a P.S. to the letter. Bershutcha osif davar shelo nishalti alayv. But with your permission, I'll add one thing that you didn't ask me about. Dat u'medina le'et ata heim kishtei shchenot she'enan nochot zu lezu. Religion and state are like two old neighbor wives who don't get along with each other. And you, dear sir, my dear prime minister, in whom the good and the welfare of the state and the peace of the state are dependent upon you, and for better or worse, don't get involved with matters of religion. In order that you should be able to focus on matters of state. God forbid you should think I'm trying to tell you what to do. Right, just because I respect you and honor you and like you, so I thought like I'd give you tell you what to do. But this idea of the tension inherent in religion and state in Medina Israel, which you know that last week they just marked the first yard site for Rav Yehuda Amital from Yeshivat Har Etzion, and there's this slate of new books that came out about him, and there's this biography that came out a couple of years ago in Hebrew, which was just published in English. I forget what it's called. It was published by Korain, by the Toby Press, by Magid. And then this festschrift of essays about him. So this was a topic that Rav Amital, Rav Amital was a Sar B'Mem Shalai, was a minister in Shimon Peres' government after the assassination. So this was a theme that he used to return to again and again and again, that separation of religion and state, I mean, what in America we colloquially call the church and state, isn't a bad thing. And it's probably, most of all, in the best interest of religion. Because when you have religion and state connected, so it's always the individual, the one little guy, he's always going to have trouble finding his place. And that's a tension that's built in. So Agnon was playing off of that tension in this story and in all the other stories in this cycle. But it was also not just a subject of the story. It's something that he apparently felt, that he thought that these tensions, you know, even writing as somebody with a big black yarmulke on, thought that these tensions are not something that's necessarily healthy for religious life in the state of Israel. And it creates a tension and a complication which has to be worked through. But in this particular story, the focus, the laser focus on sinat chinam, on, you know, we call today's session S.Y. Agnon's sinat chinam satire, Shai Agnon's sinat chinam satire. But in other words, to satirize, to make fun of it. I mean, everything here written however long ago, these are all still things that we recognize. I mean, we laugh because we're sad that we still recognize them. But they are, of course, the theme of the day. They are, of course, the theme of Tisha B'Av. When we ask, why was the Beit HaMikdash, who destroyed the Beit HaMikdash? Was it the Romans? Was it all those terrible Romans? What were the Romans doing? They were doing that. God said, go destroy the Beit HaMikdash. They destroyed. But we're responsible. We say umitnei chataeinu galino meartzeinu, because of our sins we were exiled from the land. And even though we've returned to the land, we haven't returned in the way that we once were here. Not merely the ongoing absence of the Beit HaMikdash, but the ongoing the ongoing existence of, for the time being, the majority of the Jewish people, 60 plus years after the establishment of the state, still choose to live outside of Israel. Obviously, I'm speaking to the converted, but that's like amazing. Like, could you imagine? Like, so for a lot of years, there were people in places who couldn't come, but that's almost completely no longer true. And but ultimately, the ongoing presence of division within Jewish society, both here and abroad, that is problematic. So it's a satire. It's an attempt to try to hold something up to the light, humorously, but with the effort to beg for improvement. There were a couple of people that had questions or comments.
Why was the first sanctuary destroyed?
I'm sorry, can you?
Why was the first sanctuary destroyed? It says
right.
Idolatry, immorality, and you said murder.
Yeah.
What was the nature of this murder?
What was the nature? So the Gemara there lists different examples of things that... The Gemara in Yuma, you see there are three dots. There are three dots there. So I cut out the lengthy passage where the Gemara tries to show what were the examples of each of these three sins that that did it. But there were examples of things that led to murder or murder itself. Or
infanticide, perhaps?
You mean in Echa? Yeah, no, I don't think that's what it's doing. No. I don't think that's one of the examples. No. I'm sorry, you had a question.
Oh, we can test that.
Huh? Oh, okay.
I just want to say, as someone who's been active in this protest movement.
Yeah, no, again,
I think that Agnon would be very, very supportive of what's happening there.
But again, he didn't generally get involved in those types of things.
What's happening there, say in one sentence, is that difference is not what's going on there, but listening and togetherness despite difference.
Okay, I believe you if you say that. You've been there, I haven't, but I'm pretty sure Agnon would not have gotten involved.
I don't know
if
you're very supportive
of it. What does it mean to be
supportive?
I'm sorry, one second. Let's see.
Because here he's writing in modern Hebrew, but the style seems like a very old style.
Where is he writing in modern Hebrew? In this letter or in the story?
No, he's writing in Hebrew. He's
right.
Not writing in German or
No, so Agnon's style... In 2 minutes, it's hard to address that topic fully, but briefly, he wrote in a style which was really all of his own.
Mm-hmm.
A pioneer, or among the pioneers in modern Hebrew literature, he had to forge his own style, which is why to the modern Hebrew reader he can seem off-putting, and people use that as an excuse to say, "Well, we can't read Agnon." That's not true. That's absolutely not true. But it is written in a style which is no longer contemporary. It is a hybrid of biblical Hebrew, Mishnaic Hebrew. He's trying to, in that same essay by Shalom. And again, if you want it, just email me, and I'll email it to you tonight as a PDF. Shalom actually talks about this. I think the title of the essay is Agnon, the Last Hebrew Classicist, or something.
Mm-hmm.
That Agnon, even in the period when he wasn't ritually observant, spent hours and hours and hours studying Torah.
Mm-hmm.
His daughter just turned 90. His daughter lives in Gilo. After Agnon died in 1970, his daughter was his literary executor. And she actually published from manuscripts more books, more of his writings after he died than he published in his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So she, in her memoir, she describes how he was in the habit of rising very early, long before sunrise, and he would sit in his study, and he would learn. He would learn Gemara, he would learn Rambam, and then he would daven, and then he would sit and write for as long as he could sit and write, until like lunchtime, and then he would go out wandering Yerushalayim, like, you know, collecting stories and meeting people and buying books and things like that. It's a nice life. But except you have to wake up early. But in that essay, Shalom describes how he kind of like distills the canon of Jewish literature Depending upon the story that he's writing, sometimes he'll more clearly mimic the Hasidic tale. In others, he'll more clearly mimic a rabbinic midrash. In others, he'll really try to be very carefully echoing biblical prose, depending upon the story and the plot of the story and who's speaking in the story. There are very many wonderful female characters in Agnon. But there aren't really any female narrators in Agnon's stories. Almost all the narrators in stories are men. There's one exception. There's a story called B'dmeya Meha, which I think is translated as In the Prime of Her Life, where the narrator is a young woman. And there, the story is told, the style is almost purely biblical. Because in late 19th century, early 20th century Galicia, a young Jewish girl would have read the Bible, but she would not have been versed in rabbinic literature. So putting the story through her mouth, it comes out sounding that way instead of as if it's coming from the mouth of somebody more versed in rabbinic scholarship. Mm-hmm. So the styles are very different. I'm sorry, you were going to say something?
Oh. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Yeah. So the takeaway is, Sinat Chinam is bad.